Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hi there. I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeart Media. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Pitbull.
I think that education is the real revolution, because as much as we speak about all the problems that there is in society and in the world today, my mother's always told me, son, don't worry, the world's always been coming to an end. Don't let it scare you out of living.
Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We're the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio Season 9.
Love at first listen.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
With new segments, correspondence, and a new sound.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Dura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Ruthie's Table 4, a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios.
A year ago, I used every bit of access and influence to get tickets to Cabaret for one reason only, to see Eddie Redmayne, and I went back two times. I would have liked to have gone back more. And last week, conquering my enormous fear of being afraid, I watched him in The Good Nurse and was a bit unnerved about just how beautifully he made a mass murderer not only empathetic, but almost lovable. But I, and all of us in the River Cafe, really know Eddie as a great lover of food. Actually, I'm here alone as Eddie is in the kitchen with the chefs making pizzas. A little annoying, as I don't go around acting in plays and movies, but how could I possibly mind?
Hi, I'm Jess, and I'm a chef at the River Cafe. I've been here for 4.5 years, and we're making pizzas on the pizza section. So you want to roll it out quite wide.
I obviously made the rookie error to begin with of putting far too much stuff on top.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is, I think, a sort of like day one. Exactly. All splurges over into a sort of pie rather than.
So now we can put our taleggio on.
Yeah. It's like a River Cafe pizza. This is amazing.
It's great.
Ah. Wow, delicious. Amazing. Great. Thank you so much
for showing me that. Pleasure.
Today, Eddie and I are here in the River Cafe, about to begin our conversation.
Thank you so much, Lizzie. So nice to see you.
So nice. So thank you. How was it making the pizzas?
It was, you fulfilled a childhood dream of mine.
I like childhood dreams. Yeah. What would that be?
I mean, watching chefs, like, as a kid, we didn't really go to restaurants that much, but it became a thing when we were sort of, I think about 9, 10 years old, that the weekends would be playing sport on a Saturday. And then the evenings we would go to like Pizza Express, watch pizzas be made, take them home and watch Poirot. That was like our sort of, but my parents always said that I would sort of sit there sort of clutching onto the marble, kind of watching the process. Nothing like the pizza that I got to make today. But it was extraordinary. You fulfilled my lifelong
dream. It is very dramatic.
You're absolutely right. And it's also, but also the process of watching food be made has always been something that I've just adored. And so open kitchens.
Do you think it's theatrical?
Maybe it is that. Maybe it is that. And it's also kind of organized chaos. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. There's sort of the choreography of it, even just going into the kitchen today and hearing about the process of the different numbers of chefs and where they, which section they're in charge of and how they arrive at the beginning of the day, not knowing whether they're going to be on, you know, the wood oven or making pizzas or... I love the ordered chaos of it. Mm.
There's also, I always say, and there is something about the drama of a restaurant, that the curtain goes up at 12:30, you know, and at that point everybody has to have, you know, cleaned the carpet or grated the cheese or, you know, made sure the olive oil was on the shelf and that the menu had been written. And I have never acted in a play, but I assume that if the actor doesn't know their lines or the stage set hasn't been painted or the program hasn't been printed, that the show doesn't go on.
You're totally right. And also the feeling of, I imagine it's similar in restaurants, but of when we were doing cabaret, for example, you have your own weird path of superstitions that you've created over the run of the thing that involve, for me, because I'm old, having to sort of roll out a lot in order that your body doesn't break, vocally warm up and all that stuff. But then also as a group, meeting on the circle of the stage and warming up together, greeting each other, seeing how that everyone's days have been. And at that point, the space has a kind of fluorescent light on it. It's, and then we could hear the audiences coming in, and then we all shift out and the lights go down and the space takes on this kind of magical potency, I suppose. Is that similar when you're sort of...
Yeah, it is. It's just,
the doors are about to open.
It's so collaborative. Mm. But going back about working and food, I'm so intrigued about whether actors, if it's a matinee, do you have lunch?
Well, generally what happens with me when I do theatre is I lose weight. Because you're firing on adrenaline. And the truth is, I can't eat just before a show. It's too soon. So I try and eat a really good breakfast. I try and drink a shed load of water first thing in the morning, which I'm not good at. But recently doing cabaret, my wonderful singing teacher said that apparently it takes 6 hours. Your vocal cords are the last things that hydrate. And it takes 6 hours for the hydration to get through. So sort of first thing in the morning, I would sort of come downstairs and down glasses of water. But then, of course, after the show, you're riding on adrenaline and it's late and you don't... So on matinee days, you sort of have to force yourself to eat.
Between shows.
Yeah, and normally for me, it's something kind of... It could be noodles with prawns or something light, something that's easy. There's a weird thing about our job, both in theatre and on film, that particularly on film, I suppose, because you wake up very early, you can be up at sort of, you know, 4 or 5 or something, and then back late, that I feel like you turn more into a child in the sense that your body clock, like straight after lunch on a film set, if you quite often you just hit this total wall of like you eat and then you can completely pass out because then you sort of you wake again and you kind of, I suppose, dose yourself with caffeine in order to sort of then put you through. But I never feel it when I'm not working. But that real feeling of straight after lunch, you're a bit like a baby. You sort of go straight to. But learning to eat and caffeinate yourself, the odd things about film sets and theatre is the rhythms of it. Yeah. You know, you can be shooting an intense scene on a film set and have done the wide shots and then they'll call lunch and then you'll have your food, you'll have that exhaustion, and then you, straight after lunch, you're coming back into the most intimate of close-ups and you've somehow got to recapture that energy and that spirit. And so, weirdly, food and drink does affect all that, and you are having to kind of give yourself false energies at moments to push yourself to a place that's kind of...
I thought it was a very beautiful scene in The Good Nurse that takes place at the very end in that diner where you're clearly going into a place of eating, you know, a place where you sit down in a booth and there's the expectation that you're meeting and you're going to have probably something, you know, a meal that you're going to have, and then that conversation, and it was very beautiful, I thought, that dynamic of the two of you over a cup of, I don't know, you didn't even have anything, did you?
Yeah, well, we order, but the food never makes it, unfortunately.
And then that thing that also resonates so much is leaving. You know, that you, walking out of a restaurant is quite, or a diner, or any situation where the expectation of a nice meal and then that kind of thing of walking out is pretty tough.
There was something about the architecture of that diner. Yeah. You know, diners force you to kind of sit opposite. There's that, and also the director, Tobias Lindholm, is an amazing man. So, to set the scene, it's a moment in the film when these two people who are close friends meet, and my character has been doing horrendous things, and this friend knows about it and is wired, so is recording the conversation to try and get evidence, but hasn't given away that she knows anything. So it's filled with sort of tension. And Tobias did these interesting things of, for example, giving these gigantic menus, you know, that almost stop you from being these obstacles to the scene. Like, he kept having the woman in charge of the restaurant come and interrupt the scenes. So adding these kind of odd rhythms to a scene that is filled with angles and edges, I suppose. Yeah. But no, you're right. The restaurants are extraordinary places because they're, you know, the real man, Charles Cullen, that I played, I got the sense that his relationship with Amy Loughran, which is Jessica Chastain's character, was always one of friendship. But I believe that this was the only time that he began to think maybe there was something more. She'd invited him on a sort of out of work date, and so he's got slightly dressed up, and that filled that scene with tension. So restaurants can be places of first love, they can be places of breakup, of power negotiations, of, you know, they are.
People do very private things in a very public space.
Yeah.
So people get divorced in restaurants, they announce affairs in restaurants, they get fired in restaurants. And, you know, you think, well, maybe you might want to do that at home, you know, or in the office. Yeah. And instead, there's a safety net, I think, of knowing that if you're firing somebody or announcing an affair. We have had people, you know, spill storm a glass out of wine, or very rarely, or
tell me about that drama.
Yeah, that drama. Well, the best one, I think, I've said it before, is the man who said, he called up and said that he was going to propose to his girlfriend. It would be right, will you marry me, on the cake? So he did, of course.
Oh, my God,
you marry me on the cake?
Going. Yeah.
You know it. And halfway through the meal, he came and said, cancel the cake.
Oh, my God.
And so we never knew why, you know. But it is that.
Has that person ever been back?
No, I don't know who he was. It was just like one of those. I probably wasn't even here that night.
What are the oddest things you get asked for?
Well, I have to say, I wish I had more dramatic stories. I've been asked, you know, just people, very often people want to bring their own food. You know, which is a bit odd.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, I got to bring my kid lunch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, bring that. Yeah,
can you imagine?
Bring that cheese pasta. But sometimes people will say, "Can I bring?" Somebody gave me
a truffle.
Yeah. Can you grate it? And that's fair enough. Yeah. They want to bring it.
Yeah.
Or basically, you know, that's what we were saying before: is we just say yes. You know. People want a surprise. They want the proposal moment. They want to get down on their knee, or they want. We've had a surprise party, and had to seat somebody in the restaurant, and then
take them
into the room.
I'm useless at surprise parties. I tried to hold one for Hannah, and she could see it straight on my face. It's like, there's going to be a group of people behind this doorway.
Or else you call up somebody and say, you know, is your partner so looking forward to seeing you? Yeah. And man says, I didn't know anything about it. No, we love restaurants, and we love that, as you say, that drama.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Help helps is a maxim I believe in. We all carry around stress and hardship, and when we keep it inside, it starts to chip away. Therapy is a safe place, and therapy is for everyone. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Visit betterhelp.com/Ruthie today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ruthie. BetterHelp.com/Ruthie.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm really pleased that you've chosen a recipe from the River Cafe Book 30 to read. What is that?
The recipe is rigatoni with cavolo nero and new olive oil. Serve 6, 1 kilogram cavolo nero leaves, 2 garlic cloves, peeled, 250 milliliters of extra virgin olive oil, 500 grams of rigatoni, freshly grated parmesan. This pasta is the celebration of two ingredients that arrive at the same moment in the year, cavolo nero and the first pressed peppery extra virgin olive oil. When we started the River Cafe in 1987, cavolo nero was nowhere to be found, so we brought the seeds back from Italy. Now you can find it everywhere, but only buy it after the first frost and not after the winter months. Yeah. Never after the winter months. Remove the stalks from the cavolo nero leaves. Now this is the bit about this recipe I enjoy the most.
Like
I just, there's something about the texture of cavolo nero that is so satisfying. And you can just tear out the stalks, or you can get a very sharp knife and just kind of incise down the middle. And I think that's the part of cooking that I find therapeutic is the sensations of things.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you have to keep the leaves whole. You blanch them in a generous amount of boiling salted water along with the garlic cloves for 5 minutes. You drain, put the blanched cavolo nero and the garlic into a food processor and pulse chop to a puree. In the last couple of seconds of blending, pour in about 200 milliliters of extra virgin olive oil. This will make a fairly liquid, dark green puree. Season well. Cook the rigatoni in a generous amount of boiling salted water, and then drain thoroughly. Put the pasta in a bowl, add the sauce, and stir until each piece is thickly coated. Pour over the remaining extra virgin olive oil and serve with parmesan. I chose this recipe because during lockdown, my wife, Hannah, is a wonderful gardener and had always dreamt of having a kitchen garden. And lockdown was one of those occasions when we could fully commit to it without the fear of travel and other things. And it became this amazing thing for me because I generally do the cooking in our house. And she would just start bringing things to me that were ready.
Is this in the country?
This is in Staffordshire.
Yeah.
Yeah. And cavolo nero was brought in by the armful. And I had no idea what to do with cavolo nero. And I found this recipe and it was so simple. So I made vats of the stuff and froze it, and it's lasted us for...
Good. That's good. You know, I think what's interesting also is that moment when you actually boil the garlic with the vegetable, you know. So
if you were to
fry
it,
or if you were to chop it, but somehow the fact that it's a whole clove of garlic, it almost makes it a bit creamy, doesn't it, to do that?
Yeah, it does. And it's... And there's something so odd about throwing garlic cloves into a pan of boiling water.
In a pan of boiling water.
And you have to sort of scoop them up with your ladle.
I'm so glad that you chose this recipe. So going back to the beginning of the Redmayne family, did you grow up with a feeling that food was to be taken seriously or enjoyed, or was it something, how was the feeling in your home?
I grew up, my mum is a wonderful cook. Mm. She learned from her mother, and there were three boys. I have two brothers and an older half-brother and half-sister. But it was the three of us growing up at home, and she had a lot on her hands. Yeah. Like, we were sort of running circles around and quite hyperactive. And so the food I remember from my youth was very traditional British food. It was... cottage pies. Mm. It was also the 80s.
Was it from a region of? Did she come from the north?
She actually came from Scotland. Mm. She grew up in Edinburgh, and so all those kind of things. Like, my mum learnt from my grandma, who still lives in Edinburgh, is 101 years old. I remember my grandma makes the greatest bacon sandwich. Mm.
How does she do it?
Oh, she it's streaky bacon, mm-hmm. fried to a crisp. Mm-hmm. Then you use either the softest bap that you can find or the cheapest white bread, but nothing posh about the bread, and the freshest, cheapest white bread. Mm. And you put the bread, once you've done the bacon, you put the bread onto the frying pan with all those juices, and you just fry that for a few seconds. Then what you have, I smother it in Heinz ketchup. I can't be dealing with posh ketchup.
Yeah.
And then put all the bacon in, and when it goes into your mouth,
it's salty. So back to your mother cooking in the 80s.
We digress.
We could be here for hours. But go back, because I heard you say something about it was the 80s.
What was the 80s? Well, so my memory of the, like, when mum would go, you know, get really stuck in, it was things like vol-au-vent. Like, I love a chicken vol-au-vent, and I feel like vol-au-vents need a resurgence.
Yeah. Okay, note to self.
Puff pastry with sort of creamy sauces and tarragony, chicken-y. Yeah, nice. But the thing about mum that was really influential for me is because she had so much going on, she, again, was quite a... It was the most punch for the least effort, I suppose. Yeah. And so all the recipes that I've learned, you know, from her are... They sort of got me through being a student. They got me through, and it's interesting, but it's certainly why the Cavallonero one appealed, because I don't have a huge concentration.
Did she entertain? Did she make vol au vent for her?
She did. She did entertain. And again, she was like me. She has to prep everything in advance because.
Did you get involved? Did she get her kids to come help her?
Yeah, I would always, you know, help when I could, and then do that thing of, we lived in a very tall, very thin house.
Yeah.
And I would do that thing of creeping down, sitting on the stairs, listening to, and again, it was the 80s. So when it was like a proper dinner party, everyone properly got dressed up. And I remember the glamour of that film.
Yeah. And, you know, famously, I love the story that your brother, Charlie, who... eats in the River Cafe more often. He ate in the River Cafe when HarperCollins were down the road.
Yeah.
He told a very funny story about your father and McDonald's. Would you like to tell it?
Yeah, I don't remember being there, but there's apocryphal story about my dad going to McDonald's and asking for a rare hamburger, which didn't, medium rare, exactly. Didn't go down so well.
Did you eat in restaurants, Eddie? Did you go to restaurants?
We didn't eat other than you know, Saturday night before Poirot, especially. But very occasionally, I remember once, and this was quite a seminal moment, actually, when I was probably about 9 or 10, my dad decided to take his children just before Christmas to have a roast lunch at the Savoy. And it was going to be a really, this was a big glamorous thing. And I don't know if it was something that his father had done for him. But I remember going into the Savoy and seeing the glamour and the dance, the theatre of it, I suppose. Anyway, we were sitting there and we had ordered food, and the soup came and I was sort of eating it, but I was being sort of fussy. And eventually my mum was saying, you know, look, this is incredibly indulgent. Like, we are at this extraordinary place. Why aren't you eating your soup? And I sort of said to her, oh, it's too salty, mum. My mum was like... and Dad, we have brought you to this extraordinary place.
That's rather delicate.
It's very, very, don't be ridiculous. Of course, it's not too salty. This is one of the great restaurants. Mm. Anyway, eventually, Mum tasted it and she was like, you're absolutely right. It is too salty. Mm. And so they called over the waiter and the waiter tasted it and was like, I'm so sorry. And so the chef, the head chef came out and he took my older brother James and I on a tour, apologised and said he had been on the phone or something when he had been seasoning.
Yeah.
And he took us on a tour of the kitchens of the Savoy. Nice. And it was like, I sort of watched that film Ratatouille. You know, it was again being low in height and seeing things being flambéed, and I was completely hypnotised by it.
That's you know, but also you didn't turn to your mother and say, I don't like it, which a lot of kids might just say, I don't like it. Mm. You knew that it was too salty, and you were right.
What's interesting is now later in life I'm a sort of salt addict, but
but still I think that, and actually their response, it's the same thing. I always prefer, you know, sometimes people write a letter and they'll say, you know, my fish was overcooked or my pasta was undercooked, and you say, why didn't you tell us at the time? Because of course you want that feedback. It doesn't matter if they're right or wrong. It doesn't matter. You just want them to leave having had the best meal we could give them.
Yeah. But,
so I think that you said it. And then it's a nice story. Then you went to boarding school, didn't you?
I did. So I went to school in London just across from where we are now until I was 13. And it's why I have, whenever I come to the River Cafe, I have a mixture of of joy mixed with slight PTSD because it was these towpaths that are right next to the River Cafe. And on the other side, that was where we had to run our cross country every year. So I've got sort of memories of like freezing little legs, sort of having to, my little brother was very clever and sort of feigned asthma in order to sort of get out of it, but I didn't have the ingenuity for that.
But what was the food like at boarding school?
It wasn't great.
No.
It wasn't bad, but it was also where you had this thing, a sort of tea time where you would cook yourselves. And that is where I first, and because I didn't love the food at school, I would start sort of, I mean, it was never something adventurous, but you learned to do something. You had one little hot, what's it called? A hot plate basically, which you shared between 10 students. And the sort of one pot pasta became a thing.
You could just cook, they would let, but then you would have dinner?
And then there would be dinner afterwards, but if you sustained yourself, then you perhaps didn't have to.
And so it was just, and the food was... Your brother actually said another...
What did he say?
He said that the British are very good at... The British upper class would be very good in prison because they've been institutionalized since a very young age, you know?
Yeah.
And so you get what you take and you have now.
It's but there were some people that were... I remember very adventurous. I remember one person at Eton who had come back, had been away for the weekend, and I was sort of cooking some sort of stir-in pasta, and he just sort of threw a rabbit on a frying pan and sort of cooked himself rabbit tea, which I thought was pretty robust.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...with zero qualifications...
She had a Harvard plaque.
tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion.
That this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6 million.
Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When I left home, I moved to Borough, and I lived there for a decade, right by the market. Mm-hmm. And my mum did this wonderful thing when I was about 23, I think 22. Mm-hmm. And as a Christmas present, she bought me this class, and this amazing woman took this group of us. There was random people of different mm-hmm. ages and different, mm-hmm. and took us to the market and introduced us to the traders, yeah. and taught us how to spot yeah. good, you know, decent produce sure. versus the stuff that was sure. being flung. And then we went back to her home, and this assembled group of people were taught mm. we were taught three or four very simple things,
yeah.
that totally changed the way I...
Do you remember what they were? I mean, an attitude or the recipes?
Recipes and attitude, honestly. Mm. Like, one of them was a olive oil in a pan, a punnet of cherry tomatoes, salt, and a lid on, and let it fry, then squash them once they get thingy. And at the end, you can grate in some cheese if you want, but I never do, and just put in some basil, torn basil at the end, and then the cherry tomato skins are so sort of fine that they almost disintegrate. And I sort of, since then, have never bought a tomato sauce again. But it was also, there was a time when I was about 6 or 7 when my mum had, mum and dad had an au pair, this amazing woman called Arianna, and she came from Italy. Mm-hmm. She came, and from then on, she would, when she came, went back, a friend would come, and mm-hmm. so Italian food started kind of infusing my life. And when I was just between school and university, I went and travelled and in Italy a bit, and we went to stay with her, and I remember it being this moment when it was all of the tomatoes that had been grown by her family, her extended family, had all been given to her. And it was that time of year when she made passata, basically. And I just remember her in the kitchen, and us all helping to kind of grind the tomatoes through, and that would be bottled up and vacuumed and then passed back out to the family. And that was something just sort of generous spirited about it.
It's a beautiful thing to watch, isn't it? And as you say, a process. So if we've sort of talked about school and food and family and food and being young and food, what was it like when you started your career working and food, you know, when you were acting?
I was starting to act and travel quite a lot. And travel has been one of the wonderful elements of what I do, you know, whether it's to Japan, or I spent a lot of time in Hungary and Budapest and then in North Carolina, I remember, and then down in Louisiana and having, you know, grits and crawfish and sweet corn and the simplicity of that. And one of the wonderful things about my job is, particularly when you're filming, you arrive in these cities and rather than, basically as a tourist, but you're there to work, but often the crew are from there. And so you have this amazing thing of having an introduction to cities that means you can get quite quickly sort of slightly beneath the surface and get told where the sort of great places are. And it was then, I suppose, that my sort of food tastes started expanding.
Mm-hmm. If you knew you were going to be filming in Venice or in Budapest, or would you start thinking about restaurants before you went? Would you ask people?
I'm not good at that, but I know many actors that are. The greatest of those is Jeremy Strong. Jeremy, wonderful actor and absolute passionate foodie.
Yeah.
And it was great when we were making the trial of the Chicago 7. Wherever we were, I would just get a sort of email from him saying, right, I've got us a table at this place that was on
Where
a chef's table.
Where did you film that? Where did you film
We that, shot so? A bit in Chicago yeah. and then actually in New Jersey, but we were based in New York.
We've had a lot of conversations with people who say, mostly the directors were just like, really not to stop for lunch because it just stops the flow of the filming or the acting, and then actors saying that actually the food on set could be terrible. What do you feel about working and eating?
You know, it shifts and it changes. I mean, definitely when I was starting on British sets, there's this thing, craft service, which in the UK is a couple of sort of slightly moldy digestive biscuits and, you know, some instant coffee.
Yeah.
And I remember when I did my first film in America, which was being directed by Robert De Niro and was a big budget.
The Good Shepherd.
The Good Shepherd,
I loved that movie.
Thank you. But it was a big shock to me that, because suddenly you arrived and on the streets of Brooklyn,
it was like
Borough Market. They had these sort of gigantic piles of bagels and these
I wonder
recently,
if that was
Jessica,
De Niro. Was that De Niro?
Well, I think it's also an American thing. And of course, I was completely seduced, as my children remain. They came to the set of the goodness. They're not quite sure what it is I do. But as far as they can see, I just work at a sweet shop.
But you were going to say something about Jessica.
Well, no, Jessica Chastain was saying recently what sort of tips had she learnt from about being an actor. And one of them was that Al Pacino had said that careers get ended at the craft service table. people who become sort of too obsessed with the craft service.
Yeah.
But food, my greatest on-set food was, I made a film many years ago called Savage Grace with Julianne Moore. And we shot it all in Barcelona. Mm. And even though it was set in kind of London and New York and Cadaqués, it was a sort of low-budget movie and Barcelona was passing for all of these things. But the Spanish crews were just wonderful. Lunch, you'd sort of potter out and they'd put a table up with a kind of umbrella and there'd be just the most exquisite gazpacho in little cups for everyone just to sort of start. And then it felt like you were living. I mean, I think there was even wine on the table, which I think would probably have aided my performance.
Well,
honestly.
That's what I was thinking, you know, investing in good food for the people who work for you or that you work with.
Yeah.
Is so important because we all work better, we all are better when we have good food. So I think that your mother is coming any minute.
She is.
Do not want to keep her waiting.
Yeah.
But we always say that, you know, we've discussed, you know, food in childhood and food in school and food in acting. I also say that food is comfort. If you needed food for comfort, is there something you would turn to?
Can it be anything? Quite specific.
It can be a bowl of, you know, bowl of cereal. It can be anything you want.
So there was a restaurant in France in a village called Grimaud that was an Italian restaurant called La Spaghetta.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it's there anymore, but I went there as a child and they did a starter called Fritto di Mozzarella, which was, well, for years, I've been trying to work out how the heck they make it. And everyone does their version of mozzarella and carrozza, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I think it was done with sort of the cheapest mozzarella, you know, so that really sort of plasticky stuff with breadcrumbs and just a very simple sort of fried. And then you had to eat it quickly before it got, And it remains my comfort. And my brother James, particularly my older brother James, and I would go and we would order it for starter, for main course, and for pudding. And it was, we tried to ask how they made it and they would never tell us.
Oh, let's go find out. Okay,
but that makes
me
very, very happy, that place.
Okay. I said you were a food lover.
Yeah,
I did.
Love it.
And we love you. And thank you so much for today.
Pizza's looking sad.
Oh yeah, where's that? Let's go make another one. I never tasted your pizza.
The River Cafe Lookbook is now available in bookshops and online. It has over 100 recipes beautifully illustrated with photographs from the renowned photographer Matthew Donaldson. The book has 50 delicious and easy-to-prepare recipes, including a host of River Cafe classics that have been specially adapted for new cooks. The River Cafe Lookbook, recipes for cooks of all ages. Ruthie's Table 4 is a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeart Media. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing.
This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Pitbull.
I think that education is the real revolution, because as much as we speak about all the problems that there is in society and the world today, my mother's always told me, son, don't worry, the world's always been coming to an end. Don't let it scare you out of living.
Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We're the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio Season 9.
Love at first listen.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
With new segments, correspondence, and a new sound.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Dura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.